Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order, episode 3 of season X. Today we're going to talk about distributions and I think a little bit about desktops for the noobs. So let's get started with the fortune of the day first. Nuclear war can ruin your whole compile. That's a quote, apparently, from Carl Lehenbauer. That's a pretty good quote. I like that. I imagine it would be pretty true. Okay, so today we're going to talk about distributions because that's something that people like to talk about. I like to talk about it because it's something that Linux users think about a lot, you know? It really is. It's bizarrely something that is very unique to our universe, multiverse. It's not really, obviously you don't get that from other operating systems. They don't really ever have to think about that. So Linux is kind of unique in that. I mean, BSD gets it a little bit because you do have different BSDs, nowhere near as many as Linux's, or do you? I don't know, because distribution is such a hazy term at this point. But anyway, the real question that we're all asking ourselves every day, does Linux have too many distributions? Or, said another way, too many choices? I don't know. Personally, I have gone back and forth on this issue so many times, and it's just, as I say, something very unique to the Linux users world. But let's analyze it. Let's really think about this. I realize that, you know, there's marketing problems and all these other things. Let's just break it down in every possible aspect. So the first one that really got me thinking about it again lately was maintenance. So for instance, let's say you're using Linux in real life. Maybe you're using Linux in multiple places in real life. Maybe you're maintaining these Linux systems. Should you really have to make an installer for Slackware and Fedora and Mint and not have it all? You know, do you have to do that 3 times, really? Is that, you have to do that? That's a little bit of a drag because, I mean, the Slackware package, okay, that's easy. RPM, you have to install the whole RPM build environment and go through that, but it's not the worst thing in the world. And then Deb, you have to learn how to do that and roll that up. And that's not really too bad, but it is something extra. And if you're not familiar with it, then you have to learn it from scratch. So it's a little bit troublesome. And in an ideal world, I think, no, you would not have to do that. You would publish the source, and then the packagers would make it installable. But obviously the problem is, what if the packagers are slow, or what if they don't want to package up your application? Maybe they can't. LMMS, very specifically, the latest version, 1.x.x, has a dependency on, I think, I want to say Wine or something. I could be wrong, but let's say it's Wine. And it's for VST support. So Fedora, as far as I can tell, I've not actually confirmed this, I've not looked into it, but Fedora does not have LMMS 1.x.x. It's still on like 0.4. And I'm assuming it's because of that new dependency on Wine. I could be wrong. What I'm trying to get to is that sometimes, you know, your source code may not be packageable by something because of some like weird thing down the line. Or we can't link to that, or we can't officially endorse that thing because of some legal reason. So that's something to consider. And you know, I don't want to consider it, but maybe you're not publishing your source. Maybe you're not that kind of person. Maybe you don't want to put your source code out there for some weird reason. But I mean, I'm looking at Valve, for instance, and probably other, well, some games off of like Humble Bundle. I mean, not those are not open source games. They're pay what you will games by sometimes indie or indie-like developers, but they're not giving you the source code. They're just giving you a package of an installer. So that does happen. And I saw an interview, not an interview, a talk. You probably saw it. Linus Torvalds at DebConf 2014. He was a guest there. It was in Portland, I think. And he himself said that a project that he started called Subsurface, which was a dive logging application for scuba diving. He started this thing. He does not maintain it right now. He's not the lead maintainer of this application. That's important to note, I think. But he started the thing, and they published packages for other OSs and not for Linux.
Actual application writers that want to make a package of their application for Linux. And I've seen this firsthand with the other project I've been involved with, which is my dive log application, right? We make binaries for Windows and OS X. We basically don't make binaries for Linux. So you actually want to just compile one binary and have it work, preferably forever, and preferably across all the Linux distributions. And then all the distributions come in and they screw it all up, because they break binary compatibility left and right. They update glibc and everything breaks. You can recompile everything, right? That really seems to be the mindset quite often. It's like...
And that it's a distribution problem. I mean, it really is. Like, if you can package up your application and have full confidence that it's going to run on this OS as far back as... let's say Snow Leopard, and then you can package it up and make sure that it runs on XP SP 3 or later. I don't know if there were later, but let's assume there were. And you can't figure out how to do that for Linux, then that's an issue. Now, in some cases, especially the cases where you are not going to release your source code so that people can just do whatever they need to do to get the thing running, the answer has been to define very clearly which distribution you as a user are allowed to use if you want to use that software. And a couple of different places have had to do this. Valve with Steam has done this. They've said, I think it's Ubuntu 12.04 or is it 14.04? I don't know. But that's like the distribution that you can use. Well, or Steam OS. But I mean, they're obviously, that's Linux that they are designing themselves. So one of those two things you can run Steam on. I mean, you can run it on other operating systems, or on other distros. You can run it on Fedora. You can run it on Slackware, Arch, you know, whatever you want. But in terms of guaranteed full support, they've basically defined, okay, these are the things that you can use it with. Have fun. If you use it on anything else, don't ask us for help. And I think that's a fair thing. Lightworks has also done that, the video editor, Lightworks. They've released, I think, for Ubuntu and Fedora, and that's it. You know, I mean, if you need something beyond that, then it's up to you. And I think that's fair, I really do. If Linux is going to keep its multiple distributions, I wanted to say like duplicitous, but with multipotous. It's a good word. I made it up, but it's a good one. If we want to do that, then we have to, I think, be okay with a closed source application to be a lot less open to what distribution they sort of bless. So, I mean, that works. It limits choice, which Linux users really, really don't like to be limited on. But then again, if you're using a closed source application, I'm assuming that you're okay with limited choice because closed source applications are very limiting by nature. Okay, so that's a solution to, I guess, like the problem of many distributions is for people to say, you can have all the 687 distributions you want, but we're going to, that's the, like the latest count on DistroWatch, but we're going to support this one. And that's it. That's what you get. It's not my favorite solution ever, but it's a solution. Another common solution that's kind of proposed online, you'll see it every now and again, is sort of like, well, what if we just did away with the whole multiple distribution thing? What if we actually said we're only going to keep like 4 distributions? Which ones would you take? And you would obviously have your own favorite ones. And again, that's obviously very limiting as well. And it really discounts all the hard work that people, you know, like, well, Mint, surely, PC Linux OS, Magia, all these other distributions, OpenSUSE. I mean, they put a lot of work into the thing that they're producing. And so saying that somehow, you know, that they're not going to be official Linux distributions anymore or something, kind of discounts a lot of that. So I don't know, obviously, that that's the answer. And I don't see how that would work anyway. I mean, the thing about distributions, or rather the thing about Linux, is that you can take the code and you can do whatever you want. And if you want to make your own distribution, go for it. And if you want to post it online, no one's stopping you. And then if someone wants to come along and download that, they can do that. I mean, that's freedom, my friend. Enjoy. So another what-if statement that I see around sometimes is just, and this is the one that I myself supported for a very long time, and it's just better marketing, essentially. Like, what if instead of saying, okay, we can only have 4 distributions, or, you know, there needs to be one official distribution, what if we just say that we all mutually agree that one Linux distribution is going to be sort of the public face of Linux? And you can hear me say this sort of thing on earlier episodes. I mean, I've said it before, and for a very long time, I really, really believed this was probably the right way to do it. And it basically, to summarize, it boils down to, let's just send all the noobs to Ubuntu. That's the idea, like right there. Just if someone comes knocking on the Linux door, we open it, we show them to the Ubuntu room, and then we retire to our Slackware, Arch, Gentoo, Debian, Fedora, and all the others lounge. And that, I mean, there's some sense to that, you know? I mean, it's kind of like if you make it in this far, then you have to go through your initiation. And your initiation is, can you figure out Ubuntu? We're doing half of the work for you. You ought to be able to do this. And then if you want to come in further, graduate from Ubuntu. I think the problem with that, well, is threefold. One would be that we couldn't all agree on that intro distribution. I used to pick Ubuntu simply because it was the best. That was the one that was getting all the attention anyway. So it was kind of like, oh, there's a bandwagon, and it seems to be doing fairly well. Let me jump on board. And, you know, there's some logic there. Another problem with that is that it's a little bit, I think, a little bit backwards, actually. Not maybe for everyone, but certainly for me and for, I think, a lot of Linux, serious Linux users, I think that is backwards. I think it's taking, you know, it's taking you from, like, power user of your old OS, dumping you as a dumb user into a dumbed down, and I mean that in the nice way, a dumbed down distribution, and then saying, okay, you can now progress to being a power user of a harder distribution. And by harder, I don't mean harder. I mean less dumbed down, I guess. Whereas it seems like what you should be doing is just going from a power user to someone who's a power user of a new OS, and you have to figure that thing out. And then you can graduate to whatever other thing that takes care of all the messy business that you didn't really care about anyway for you. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm trying to say start with Slackware and then graduate to something if you don't like Slackware as much by the end of it all. But you will like it, so who cares? And the third issue, I think, would be, you know, even if we did that thing, if we said, okay, if we all got together and said, okay, we're going to send everyone to Mint. Forget Ubuntu. Let's send everyone to Mint. That's where they'll start out. And if they get tired of Mint after they learn it and learn all of its conventions and become really good at Mint, and then we'll offer them passage into the Slackware lounge or the Gentoo lounge or the whatever. And that's what we'll do. The problem with that would be, and I have found out this the hard way, is that if you're not using it, you really can't support it. I used to really, really think otherwise. I you can hear me say this on many a past episode, and it's been fairly recently, to be honest, where people are relying on me very, very heavily for support. If you're not using the exact distribution with the exact same desktop as your users are using, then your support is rendered severely impaired. Because, I mean, they'll ask you a question. They'll ask you how to do something. And obviously your mind goes to, well, how would I do that on my OS, on my distribution? And that's what your first answer is going to be. And you're going to think, well, I don't actually use Mint, and I haven't really used Cinnamon a whole lot, but I imagine that what you're looking for is somewhere in system settings. Look for a keyboard control panel. See if somewhere in there there's something to switch the language. I don't know. Look around. You know, and it's just like, well, why am I asking you then? And they're asking you because you're the one who got them into this stupid OS in the first place. And here you are kind of like fumbling around like an idiot. I've learned that the hard way. Really. Not a good idea. I don't do that anymore, honestly. Not a good idea. At least not for me. Maybe your capacity for knowing several distributions is better than mine. But I get really bad about it. And, too many distributions in my head start to really, really weaken my guru power. And believe me, it's not all that good in the first place. People only think it is. So it's kind of embarrassing. So, yeah. So what is the answer? Like, what do we do about all these distributions? We have, I think, on DistroWatch, like over 600 distributions are listed. Everyone knows that about 500 of those are completely inactive, and the rest maybe, you know, I mean, there's probably, out of the remaining number, there's probably like 100 of them that, I mean, yes, by a technical term they are a distribution, but in reality it's just someone who, again, you can download it and do it for free, so why not? So you just make a distribution. Maybe it's just your personal preference of how, you know, when you install your OS, that's how you want it to look. So it's a distribution, but it's just something that you happened to make for yourself, and maybe one other person in the world even bothers looking at it. But then there's still that core set of distributions that Linux news sites kind of keep tabs on. You keep seeing their names pop up, you know, the Magia, the PC Linux OS, SUSE, Slackware, Arch, Gentoo, Funtu, Crux, Ubuntu, Mint, Fedora, Puppy. There's more. There are more that Pardis. Red Hat, CentOS, Scientific Linux. Did I say Debian? Mint? I probably said all that. Anyway, there's a lot out there. And it gets very confusing. People get confused about it. People look at us and they say, Linux users can't even decide what distro to use, whatever a distro is. How are they ever going to do anything worthwhile? So it's embarrassing. Here's the thing. First of all, I think that the term distribution is, it's problematic. I think early on it was one thing and now it's something different. So that's a problem, but I don't want to talk about that yet because I have a theory about that, and I'll get to that some other time in this episode. The main thing, I think, is very similar to what I was saying either previous episode or the episode before, and that is the concept of this efficacy of the internet, you know, this kind of like, oh, we're a global society now. Well, yes, we are, but me, Klaatu, I'm not global. I'm right here. I am right here where I am right now. And I realize that I'm also inside of your web browser talking to you right now, which is weird for me. And maybe for you, because maybe you feel like I'm actually talking to you. And I am. I'm imagining that I'm talking to you. But I'm not really there, right? Klaatu is right here. And when the video camera turns off, I'm going to walk off and do other things. So the world has become small, as it were. The internet does bring us closer. But even within the big open space that is the WWW, there are tribes, there are communities. And we could call them local, even though they're not necessarily actually physically local. And when you join a distribution, you start using a distribution, you start kind of interacting with that distribution, you're joining that community of people who basically are all agreeing to do certain things a certain way, and that's kind of like the mutual agreement that goes on within a distribution. And that's great. But don't let yourself get fooled into expecting or wanting, for that matter, a big global movement designed to standardize everything. Because honestly, there simply is no such thing. What you like does not necessarily work for someone else, somewhere else, outside of your community, whether it's physically local, like very physically local, or whether it's just an online community. Yes, we have to accept that. We have to be okay with that. So these local communities online are great. It's a distribution. You can be a part of that. It's great. You can all do things a certain way, and I'm sure you'll enjoy that, and you'll be talking the same language. But locally, physically locally, like right here, that's not the case. You are the center of your own world, really. So if you're setting up a game room, then maybe Ubuntu is your best bet, because Valve supports that. They make that be your best bet. You might rather use Slackware, and you can do that, but you're doing the porting yourself, so enjoy. Maybe you're setting up a multimedia studio for yourself. You want to use Fedora. Fine, but you get to maintain all the updates and libraries that want to break with every new release of Fedora every 6 months, or 9 months, as it usually ends up being. So when you're implementing Linux, you are the final word on what Linux is in your local community. That's really ultimately the point here. You are the definer of all the open standards. You get to decide for everyone around you who's going to be using Linux, whether because they want to or whether it's just because they're using your computer lab and that's what you installed, you tell them, you're defining for them what Linux is. Now, I used to be a little bit afraid of that because I thought, well, it's not me. I don't define what Linux is for these people. The internet defines what Linux is for these people. They're going to go online and they're going to look up tutorials and they're going to certainly find the Ubuntu tutorial, and it's going to be, five versions out of date, and it's not going to make any sense. It's going to be talking about Unity version 1, and all the buttons are going to be in different places now. It just doesn't work that way. The internet, in order to define people's Linux experience, it's really not as powerful as you might think it is. You, on the other hand, are a really powerful force locally. If you tell people, yes, this runs Linux, and this is how you work this application or this program. This is the Linux desktop. It's called KDE. This is how you use it. That becomes Linux because you said it's Linux. That becomes the one distribution, in other words. Now, they can go home and they can do internet searches and find out about other distributions all they want. They can get curious about that all they want. They're free to do that. Linux is free. Linux has a lot of choice. If that person wants support from you, just like if you want support from, say, Valve or Lightworks or any closed source application that says, hey, this is what you use, and if you use that, then we'll give you support. If they want support from you, then they can use the distribution that you have defined as the ultimate Linux, the definitive version of Linux. And that works locally. It doesn't work globally. It doesn't work really on the whole internet, but it does work within your immediate area with people who can actually call you up or knock on your door and ask, hey, how do I do something? It really, really works well in that case. And even online, in your, you know, in whatever capacity you are a Linux guru online, you're basically making your own Linux there as well. You're telling people, this is my corner of the web, and in this corner, we use Slackware. And that's what I'm going to support. And if you have a question, you can ask me about Slackware. And if you have any other question about any other distribution, I can't help you. And it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be a mean thing. You don't have to tell people that you absolutely refuse to support Ubuntu or whatever. But being honest with them and telling them that you know how to use Slackware, you know how to do the things that Slackware does, you know how, you know the Slackware ways of doing things. And that becomes Linux. Yeah, there's 687 or whatever distributions. But for me, Klaatu, there's one. And that's what I can help you with. So that's, I think, ultimately the answer, at least for me, to whether or not Linux has too many distributions. No, it doesn't have too many distributions. You might have too many distributions. I might have too many distributions. So if you want to change how many distributions of Linux there are, then it's not something that you have to petition, you know, the community for. You don't have to petition the whole world, hey, let's stop all the madness and get rid of all the distributions that I find inconvenient. You simply have to petition yourself. You just have to tell yourself, okay, I'm going to start supporting this OS, whether they're new users or old users or experienced users or artists or business people or whatever. This is the distribution I'm going with. And Linux is Linux, right? I mean, if you can do it on one, you can do it on another. So it's not the whole myth of like, oh, this is a good Linux distribution for beginners. I just don't find that to be true. I find the truth to be a beginner, a new user is using it because they're a friend of mine. Or they're going to become a friend of mine because they're using Linux. And in that event, if they want support from me, I can help them really, really well with Slackware. And anything else, on many, many times I will simply have to bow out and say, look online. Find your community online and ask them how to do that. Because I'm not the person to be able to help you. So, that, I believe, is the answer to the distribution problem. And that is just to personally decide what your distribution is and make that your distribution. And stop the illusion that you have to have a different Linux for each different type of user. I don't know where that came from, that myth. You know, and you see articles all the time talking about that. What Linux should you use if you are doing so-and-so? That's not how distributions work. There's not a distribution that is, quote, good for business, good for art, good for, you know, general use. That's just not how it works. I mean, it's a fun article to write. You know, I've seen the articles in Linux format, and online all over the place. You know, I mean, they're there, and they're fun, and as a Linux user, you like distributions. They're fun to sort of like follow and track and kind of like experience and see the screenshots of them and stuff. But in real life, that's not how they work. It's just because Fedora has a blue logo does not make it a more professional operating system than the one with the orange logo. And that doesn't make it any better or worse than the one with the green logo. It's Linux. And people are putting packages into it and putting it on a disk and sending it to you. That's all it does. You have the answer, my friend. You know what distribution there is and that people should use. So use that distribution. Get to know it. Learn it like the back of your hand. And then support it. And that'll be the Linux distribution in your world. Great coffee break, I think, and just what we needed, I think, to get started with the Noob Corner. I want to talk about a desktop topic for noobs, because this is something, it's one of those things that you don't really think about that often, but it does tend, at least for me, it tends to come up frequently, and it's one of those really, really strangely powerful things about Linux that when you see it happen, it's really exciting. It's actually really, really exciting. They're called .desktop files. That's .desktop files. These are launchers of sort, and I'm going to teach you how to make them, and you should make one for yourself. And I almost guarantee you at some point, if you're one of those people who tries lots of different applications, you're gonna make one of these for yourself at some point for some application out there that doesn't have a traditional Linux installer. So let's try it out. .desktop files, what are they and why do they exist? Well, the best way to illustrate that, I guess, is to show you what they appear to be. So I'm going to open up Dolphin, and I'm going to right-click in this location bar, the URI bar, and click Edit. And then I'm going to edit it, that's so hard to say, to Applications colon. So I'm just typing in Applications colon, and then I'm hitting Return. And here we are in my Applications location, I guess, is what we'll call it, because this isn't really a folder, but it's sort of a meta location. But as you can see, there are a bunch of different categories that KDE sort of sorts its applications into, and one of them is multimedia, so that seems interesting. So let's kind of scroll through here and see what we have. So here's MuseScore. This is an interesting one. So if I click on this application, then it predictably launches the application called MuseScore, and that's sort of like that's expected behavior, right? That makes sense. So there's that. Now if we go over to the K menu and click on it and type in MuseScore, sure enough we have the application there, and if we click on it or launch it, whatever, it launches the application. So that's again pretty expected. And you know, no matter sort of how you look at it, if you look for MuseScore, you'll typically find the little icon, and if you click on the icon, it expectedly opens the MuseScore application. And so my point being, this is a .desktop file, believe it or not, and I can prove that to you by opening up a terminal and going into /usr/share/applications. And doing an ls provides me a lot of feedback, so I'll just do an ls and I'll grep for Muse score. And well, nothing came up. Well, that's odd. Now we could find out a little bit more, and this is kind of why I've chosen this example, because this is kind of like almost the worst case scenario. So what I'm going to do is right click on the Muse score in the Dolphin window, and I'm going to go to Properties. And in the Properties window, you'll see that indeed it is called Muse Score, and it's a WYSIWYG music score editor is what it calls itself, and it does say it's the contents is a desktop configuration file. But notice that there's nothing in here that says like .desktop, and the size is 0 bytes. That seems pretty odd. So there's a lot of like sort of very mysterious things going on here, and it's really just because we're in a desktop environment, and this is how KDE has been programmed to treat this particular kind of file. If you go over to the Applications tab in the Properties window, which, by the way, the Properties window, you'll notice, says Properties for MScore. So that's just kind of interesting. The name is MuseScore, the description is MScore, the comment is WYSIWYG, music score typesetter, and command to launch the thing is MScore. So this sort of tells us indirectly that what we're actually looking for over here in the GUI is not MuseScore, but MScore. And sure enough, if I do an ls and I grep for MScore, not MuseScore, I do see that there's a file called mscore.desktop. So let's do a file on mscore.desktop. And it tells me that it's ASCII text. Now, how could this file possibly be ASCII text? It clearly is an application, right? Because I click it and it launches an application. Well, this is the ingeniousness of the modern Linux desktop. And what's actually happening here is that mscore.desktop is interpreted by KDE not by the file name, but by the contents of the file. And it's specifically told to do this. This is a free desktop specification, and it says we're going to all agree that a file known as .desktop, if it ends with the string .desktop, we're going to tell the user that it's an application. It's not going to be an ASCII text file to them. It's going to look like an application, like an icon that'll launch an application. So if we're looking now at the contents of that file, and you see that it starts with the phrase desktop entry in square brackets and gives us the version, and it gives us that comment that we saw earlier in the application properties window, and it has this command right here, or this line right here, that says exec equals mscore, and the generic name is mscore, the icon is mscore, and then it gives us the category. It gives us a couple of different categories, and it gives us a few things that will open up by default by this application. And the name it gives itself is MuseScore with a capital M and a capital S. So if we look at this file and the Dolphin window at the same time, and I'm going to kind of filter everything else out, but so we're looking at this thing, and we see that the icon says MuseScore with a capital M and an S, so that's that. It's actually showing us the name, and if we get our properties window back, we'll see that the type that it gives us is directly taken from the comment, and the description is directly taken from the generic name. So this is all sort of an interpretation of this essentially one file. It's a configuration file for an icon, is sort of what you could think of it as, I guess. So it's only because KDE, the desktop, is told, hey, when you see a .desktop file, show the user an icon, look in that .desktop file and grab its name and put that as your name, and when someone clicks on you, don't open up a text file, do this other thing, such as exec equals mscore. So we could test this out more or less, like just by saying, okay, we're going to type in mscore. That's what happens when we click on this file. So what happens if we just type in mscore into a terminal? Yes, that launches the application directly. So essentially, if you're ever looking at a desktop file, a .desktop file, and you look at the exec line, then you know that that's when you know that when you're clicking on that icon, that's what's actually getting launched. So this gets really, really handy on applications that don't have traditional Linux installers. If memory serves, the programming language processing is such an application. I don't remember that it had its own desktop file. What it did was you untarred the thing, and you could just put it in anywhere, really, and then you go and click on the icon and it'll launch processing. In fact, we can kind of look at that. Let me get that back. So this lives in /opt/processing. So I'm going to open up a file to that. And now what it does when we click on the processing icon, like the .desktop file right here, is it launches this file here. So if we click on this, it possibly may actually even open processing, and it does. So, like, in a much more generic way, this is sort of like, this is what processing, this is how a Linux application is actually, it actually lives like this. And this is a good example, I guess, because it's kind of all in one folder, you know, it's all in one directory called processing. And it's got mostly everything that it needs to run in here. I mean, it doesn't have everything it needs to run, because they're assuming you're going to run it on Linux. So they assume that you're, running a Linux kernel, and you have glibc, and, you know, things like really low-level stuff that everyone has on their computer if they're using a computer. But everything else, like, you see that there's a bunch of Java stuff, there are tools and modes and the core and libs, and then this boring-looking shell script or whatever it is, and it's kind of unimpressive, but this is what does it. Like, you click on this thing, and it starts up a Java application in Java, and it kind of has some error catching so that if it crashes, it can tell you why, and so on. But, you know, it's kind of, I mean, can you imagine if every application file on Linux looked like just any old shell script? I mean, it would be functional, and it would work, and frankly, half the time I launch an application from the command line anyway, so it doesn't really matter, but it does get kind of boring. And so it's kind of nice that we can say, well, instead of just going to /opt/processing and clicking on processing, I'd rather have this in my menu. So let's you and I design a launcher for something, just so that you can kind of see how it all works. Now I have, you know, pretty much everything. Let's see if I've got, I do. So I have pretty much everything already in my menu, but we'll make one anyway. So right now I'm in user share applications, so I need to be root in order to do this. And so I'm going to open up this file here, because I created this. So it's for Planter, which has a GUI mode. This is a little bit more verbose than it really needs to be, because frankly none of these languages are even going to be called on my system. So I just want to kind of show you the bare minimum kind of setup that you would want to have in order to create your own. So the first line you need is to have the desktop entry, and the second or another one that you need is the name, the proper name, and so that's what's going to be displayed on the, you know, in the GUI. And you can give it different translations for that name. And then the next line that you need is the command that you want to use in order to launch it. And this is a great example, I guess, because it's not just a simple command. So for this application which I wrote, it's a little Python script, but it'll run from either the shell or a GUI. But in order to run it from a GUI, you have to tell it to run from the GUI. So in this case, the exec is a lot more than just the word, you know, the name of the application. It's
it's the whole string of stuff that it needs to find, everything that it needs to run, without sort of asking more questions. So then the icon is Planter. So the reason that it's just called Planter, which seems a little bit vague, but here's how the icons work for the default thing. I mean, you can give it an exact path, it'll work, but the desktop files within user share applications, it basically assumes that the icon, unless told otherwise, the icon that it's going to refer to is located in /usr/share/icon/high-color, and then within the folders, whichever folder you happen to have given it. So it'll search and intelligently find the best case to use. And in this case, I guess I didn't put, oh wait, apps. There's the planter.svg, and that's all I've given it, is planter.svg. But it knows that if it looks in this path, usr share icons high color, and then some other directory, like whether it's 512 by 512, or 256 by 256, or 24 by 24, 48 by 48, whatever, and then in whatever category it needs to look in, and then the term that it wants that you're telling it, then it will load that in, whether it's an SVG or a PNG, or I don't know, probably other, probably a like a BMP maybe, I don't know, but that's how that works. So I'm just telling it Planter because I happen to know that when I installed this application, it sent the Planter icon into the correct folder. But I have definitely used other locations. In fact, I think I would bet if I open up the processing one again. No, I must have installed that correctly as well. But I know that for some application out there, I've had to specify it, you know, like, oh, I put that in opt planter or whatever. But in this case, I didn't, so I won't do that. The type is that it's an application. That's good to know so that it knows where to find the icon and knows how to execute it. Categories, it's really, I just kind of look at other categories of similar applications and kind of use them. It's Qt and KDE because it does use PyQt. It's a system and a file tool and a file manager related thing because that's what it does, is it generates file directory trees for projects. The generic name is what will pop up in my properties window, and I believe it comes up in some menus. I don't know what the xtext is. Terminal is, no, it's not a terminal application, I want it to be a GUI. MIME type is, it's a directory tool, and then I don't remember what all of these things are for. And I didn't really give it, oh yes I did, I gave it a category, good for me. Okay, so that's the desktop file for a real live application that exists. Now, if we go back to applications in the virtual file system, I guess is what we would call this, and we look in system, I'm guessing, we should see this Planter tool, which I've updated the icon because I just found out earlier today or this week that MongoDB is actually already uses an icon a lot like that, so I've updated that. But anyway, so it's a desktop configuration file. It sees itself as a system tool because that's what we gave it in the category, and it sees itself, again, the name is Planter, the description is project creator, the command is this thing. Didn't read the comment for some reason, I'm not really sure why, but there you go. That's Planter. And the cool thing about this little file is that we could put it, you know, anywhere, really. I mean, it doesn't have to be in a certain location in order to work. So I could drag it over to, for instance, my desktop. And now it's a desktop file, so if I click on it, oh dear, it doesn't launch. Why not? Well, the reason is because when you transfer a .desktop file somewhere, it's programmed, KDE, the desktop, whatever, is programmed to not execute it unless you explicitly tell it, yeah, it's okay to execute this thing. So I could either click, yes, I trust this program, and then it will launch, and it does, or I could go into it preemptively and go into the permissions, and I could tell it to make this executable. But since I've already okayed it at that warning symbol, it is now marked executable. I'm going to get rid of it, though, because I don't really want that on my desktop. So if I if you're distributing it and you need it executable or whatever, just do chmod 755 and then planter.desktop or however you want to mark it executable. It's fine. And that's it. So the point here, the real, I guess, the exciting thing that I'm not sure if I'm really conveying is that with a .desktop file, you can do all manner of things. So if we create really quickly here, if we create a an xeyes.sh and we give it shebang shabat bin bash, and we just say, let's say xeyes. So this is a really boring little program. We're gonna make it executable. But now we don't. So now we need something to launch this application, let's say, because we're going to send this application to someone, and we want them to be able to just click on it magically and have it all work. So what we'll do is we'll copy. This is kind of how I do this all the time. I just copy a known good desktop file, and then I edit that. So I'm looking at this. And this is too small for you to see, but we'll just change it around. So we'll say, there we go. We'll say it's a desktop entry. The comment is, we'll make it say, look at me. And then we'll execute when that happens, xeyes, because that's fun. And the generic name will be xeyes as well. But just for fun, let's... No, that needs to be that. The generic name, yeah, can be xeyes. We don't need the Russian version for this display. So the icon, we could set it to xeyes, but we could also just set it to really anything. So let's set it to Planter and see what happens. And the name will be look. Startup notification, we don't need that. It's not going to run in the terminal. And we'll leave everything else as is, even though it's completely wrong. And now, of course, we need to chmod this thing so that it's executable, so that we don't get an error when we try to run it. And now we'll go out to our desktop. Oops, I didn't mean to zoom in. So we'll go out to our desktop, and we see, as I said, it's going to have a planter icon, and it does. And if I click on it, it brings up the famous eyes. So there you go. That's desktop. And now I've used this in real life for things like, you know, if I need to write a script that will convert video, and I don't want to have to tell people, okay, well, just run this script by going to a terminal and running, you know, convert.sh. And if it doesn't work, make sure that it's executable, and then really make sure that you have everything in the right path and all that other stuff. It's just, you know, you just send someone a desktop file that executes some command, tell them to mark it executable or to click on it, and then okay, let it execute, and then it's like their own little built-in, you know, to them it looks like an application that you wrote, and all it really is a shell script and a front end with a .desktop file. It's really, really handy. It's pretty amazing. And all the launchers on Linux, that's all they are, is plain text files. You can write your own, you can send them to people, you can use them yourself. It's really, really nice. The other way to mildly change some of these things, and this is really only limited to the menu, so don't, you know, it's best to go in, I think, and actually change the desktop files. But if you look at if you right click on your K menu and you go into menu editor, then you'll see that all of the, you know, all of the things that you are used to seeing in applications are there. We should see Planter here somewhere. No, it was in System. Yeah, here's Planter. So we could go in and like change the name or add a comment because I don't think it was there before. We could add a, you know, modify the command. We can even change the icon that it's going to show us, you know, which would really be annoying. So I'm not going to do that actually. And then as long as you save that, it will save it. And then your menu will reflect your changes. So that's kind of a lighter way of getting into these desktop files, but you're not actually changing the desktop file, you're kind of adding metadata to it. So generally speaking, if I'm trying to do something that I, you know, and I know what I'm doing, I'll just edit the .desktop file. And if I'm creating one, then I'll use one that exists. I'll save it as something else, and then I'll go in and edit it to suit my needs. And
pretty
it works
cool.
out really, so, really well.
I mean, I think that's one of those things that really, for me at least, completely changed how I saw computers. Once I realized, I mean, I couldn't even fathom it. But I mean, there's no difference between a .desktop file, you know, this mysterious icon that launches an application. No difference between that and a shopping list that I'd made, or a to-do list, or whatever, a letter, whatever. They're just plain text files. That's it. That's all they are. And the computer knows, because of certain conditions, to treat one differently than the other. And that goes a lot deeper than you realize, because it's not just .desktop files. It's programming even. But I mean, like the init's scripts that I was talking about two episodes ago, maybe, plain text. They're just plain text file. You type them in and then the computer parses them and does magical things with them. And again, like programming is basically the same thing. Okay, granted, it's usually a bunch of weird-looking, you know, special syntax. I mean, it's almost like a foreign language, but that doesn't change that it's still the keyboard that you just type it in and you compile it and the computer translates it. But that's how it works. So that's really, really, I don't know. For some reason, just the idea that plain text was so powerful, and Linux leverages it so well. I mean, really, really thoroughly. And that's an important part of Linux, those config files, and they're powerful to understand.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Coffee should be free for everyone to take as they please.